not level of defeat. And certainly, I personally think that the 2011 revolution and its generation have been defeated. On a personal level, Allah has not been defeated. When we talked about they're making an example of Allah, that's probably their main concern now. You make an example of someone, and then you have to release him without having broken him. That is very, very hard.
You're asking that Allah be released and deported to Britain?
Either he's released and he travels to Britain, or he be deported to Britain. I want him safe and out of the country.
That's Leila Swaif and Sanese, the mother and sister of the political prisoner Ala Abdel Fattah. I interviewed them in their family home here in Cairo, Egypt, this weekend. And that does it for this show. Special thanks to Sharif Abdelkaddous, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, and Nermeen Sheikh here in Cairo. And to Mike Burke, Charina Nadura, Robbie Karen, and Julie Crosby in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Multnomah County DA publishes a list of dismissed cases from the public defender shortage. Governor Kate Brown pardons marijuana possession charges. And it's National Caregivers Month, recognizing the families that provide billions of dollars worth of care. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 22nd, 2022. I'm Eric Leuschner. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt will publish a list of nearly 300 misdemeanors and felony cases that have been dismissed because there wasn't enough public defenders for them. Defendants at trial have a right to a lawyer, and with not enough to go around, hundreds across the state have been left charged with a crime and no lawyer to represent them. Schmidt said in a statement, quote, "The public must be empowered with this information to understand the scope of the crisis." He also called the lack of public defenders a threat to public safety. It's a problem that's bigger than the Portland metro area. Oregon legislators say they plan to address the public defender shortage in their legislative session in April. Oregonians with marijuana possession on their record will see the charge pardoned, thanks to a new move from Oregon Governor Kate Brown. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown just announced she is pardoning thousands of people convicted of simple possession of cannabis. She is also forgiving more than $14 million in unpaid fines and fees. The pardon applies to convictions for possession of 1 ounce or less of marijuana. Other conditions apply. Cases must be pre-2016, the person convicted had to be 21 years of age or older, possession had to be the only charge, and there must not have been other victims. This comes a month after President Joe Biden pardoned those convicted under federal law and in the District of Columbia. Biden has been calling on governors to issue pardons for those convicted of state marijuana offenses, which make up the vast majority of possession cases. The governors of several states, including Colorado, Nevada, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Washington, have begun taking steps to grant pardons to those with low-level marijuana convictions. Several states, including California, Illinois, and New Jersey, automatically review criminal cannabis convictions. In other jurisdictions, eligible persons must petition the courts for a review. As a result of these new laws, an estimated 2 million Americans had their cannabis-related convictions set aside in recent years. Oregon lawmakers passed legislation in 2019, which established procedures for people found guilty of low-level marijuana possession offenses to file a motion with the court to have their convictions set aside. However, relatively few Oregonians have done so. In Oregon, the governor's pardon should remove 47,144 convictions for possession of a small amount of marijuana from individual records. Clearing those criminal records eliminates barriers for employment, housing, and educational opportunities. Oregonians passed a ballot measure legalizing recreational use of marijuana in 2014, making Oregon one of the first states to do so. In November of this year, Maryland and Missouri voters also legalized cannabis, but voters in Arkansas, South Dakota, and North Dakota rejected their measures. Maryland and Missouri joined 19 other states and the District of Columbia in making recreational marijuana legal. Brown said, quote, "No one deserves to be forever saddled with the impacts of a conviction for simple possession of marijuana, a crime that is no longer on the books in Oregon," end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Mount Hood Meadows, the popular ski resort, won't be opening on Thanksgiving weekend as in years past. Why? There's not enough snow on the mountain for the lifts to be in operation, the resort says. Another snowstorm is expected in the middle of this week, so the resort says the beginning of December looks promising. Meteorologists have said that there's a lot of snow to look forward to in the forecast, with the La Nina weather pattern bringing more wet weather through the winter. Mount Bachelor Resort in Bend expects to open their lifts this Friday. Ron DeSantis is catching up to Donald Trump in very early polling. A Georgia judge approves weekend early voting amid controversy, and most Democratic voters now believe President Biden would win if he runs for re-election. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
If the CEO of the railroad or other top executives at that railroad, I wonder if they would get fired if they got sick or if they had a medical emergency in their families. I doubt very much that they would get fired.
Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont says he supports railroad workers' efforts to fight for increased medical leave as they continue to negotiate new contracts. One of the largest railroad unions narrowly voted to reject a contract deal brokered by the White House in September. Experts say a national rail strike ahead of the holidays could cripple the U.S. economy. Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock is encouraging Georgians to vote early in the state's December 6 runoff election, but Republicans say not on Saturday.
If you eat on Thursday and shop on Friday, certainly you can vote on Saturday or on Sunday.
The state of Georgia is appealing a judge's ruling that allows counties to offer early voting this Saturday ahead of the runoff between Warnock and his Republican challenger, Herschel Walker. Republicans say state law prohibits voting on days following a Georgia state holiday, which includes Friday.
We're winning big, big, big in the Republican Party for the nomination like nobody's ever seen before. Trump at 71, Ron DeSantis at 10%, Mike Pence at 7%.
Former President Donald Trump always enjoys a good crack at his political rivals, but a new Harvard Caps Harris poll survey finds Florida Governor Ron DeSantis closing the gap with Trump as they both vie for a shot at the White House in 2024. DeSantis has gained 11 points, earning the backing of 28% of Republicans, while Trump fell 9 points to just 46%. Meanwhile, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Premila Jayapal, says President Joe Biden should run for a second term in 2024 and that he'll need the backing of progressives to win.
We are going to have to keep the hope alive and show the pathway for people to turn out in 2024 so we can get the rest of the president's agenda done.
A new USA Today Ipsos poll finds nearly three-quarters of Democratic voters say Biden could win if he runs again. Biden says he'll make an official decision on whether to run early next year. Two Arizona counties have voted to delay certifying their ballots from the midterm elections following Republican claims that vote counting machines were not properly certified. Republican gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, who lost to current Secretary of State Katie Hobbs, has claimed without evidence that voters were disenfranchised. Finally, the Justice Department has officially classified the suicide of a Capitol Police officer who defended the Capitol during the January 6th attack as a line of duty death, therefore allowing his family to receive benefits. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Tribal leaders in New Mexico are frustrated over the roadway safety. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg met with tribal leaders in Albuquerque, New Mexico last week to discuss roadway safety in tribal communities, infrastructure investments, and how the Biden administration can work with indigenous communities. Leaders shared their concerns and frustrations about lack of funding and increased traffic, which is causing faster wear and tear on roads and highways. Former governor of Laguna Pueblo, Richard Luarke, says the department has provided resources, but stressed it's no longer enough.
The consideration for the formula used to determine how much funding tribes receive definitely needs to be revisited because, as you're hearing from the rest of the leadership here, it's not enough.
Charles Riley, who spoke on behalf of Acoma Pueblo, says there are many challenges when it comes to applying for funding.
Many of our tribes here in the United States do not have the resources or expertise to apply for these grants.
The concerns for an increase in traffic going through Pueblo communities has contributed to crimes, says All Pueblo Council of Governors Chair Mark Mitchell. He says while the Pueblo's economy has benefited from increased transit, it has also caused more problems.
Dangerous activities like drug and human trafficking have found their way into our communities at an alarming rate.
Buttigieg says he's aware of how difficult it is to combat issues with infrastructure.
As a mayor who maintained roads and did battle with potholes and other maintenance issues for a living before I came into this role, I do not know how you do it.
The secretary committed to working with tribes. The Center for Rural Affairs is launching new makerspaces on two Nebraska Indian Community College campuses for making, learning, exploring, and sharing. Eric Galatis has more.
The makerspaces will include traditional low-tech tools and also significant investments in cutting-edge technologies. Among other tools available to students and tribal members, Christine Flyinghawk with the Center's Native Communities Program is especially excited to install a Glowforge.
It can engrave and cut anything from wood to leather to glass. And then we have the new Cricut 3 Maker, which can make up to a 12-foot vinyl sign. We will have a sublimation printer.
Flyinghawk explains that a sublimation printer can print images on just about anything, from cups to koozies to keychains. The center will also install a t-shirt press, a sticker and button maker, a sewing machine, an embroidering machine, and a quilting machine. Workshops will help people get hands-on experience with each new tool. The makerspace also aims to facilitate experimentation, where people can test out new ideas for a side hustle or a full-on business. Angelina Magrel with the center says financial support and expert guidance for creating a business plan will also be available to help people realize their goals.
That was Eric Galatas and Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News. Family members provide billions in unpaid care. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
It's National Family Caregivers Month, a time of year to underscore the important work these folks do. Family caregivers provide unpaid aid to the loved ones in their lives, but often are unrecognized for the crucial role they play in ensuring people are able to age in place. Lori Stanton is the Southern Regional Manager for the Oregon and Southwest Washington chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. She says sometimes the people family members are caring for aren't able to say thanks, especially if they have conditions such as Alzheimer's disease or dementia.
For the Alzheimer's Association in general, we just want caregivers to know that we see them and we appreciate what it is that they're doing.
Stanton says people who know family caregivers should reach out and see what they can do to help that person out. There are about 460,000 family caregivers in Oregon providing $5.7 billion of unpaid care, according to a 2017 estimate. Dr. Vicky Schmall is head of Aging Concerns in West Lynn, an organization that educates and trains family caregivers. She says these providers are the backbone of the long-term care system. Schmall notes that one of the biggest challenges for caregivers is taking care of themselves.
Their health being intact also has implications for the person that they're providing care to. And if their health and well-being goes downhill, that also has implications for the person that they're giving care to.
At some point, family caregivers might have to decide that a care facility is a more suitable place for someone. On December 2nd, AARP Oregon is hosting an event on how to find the right long-term care facility, which Schmall will be part of.
We will be looking at different types of facilities in Oregon, and we will also be talking about the importance of advanced planning rather than waiting for a crisis to occur in terms of seeking long-term care.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6, it's Project Censored. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather is mostly cloudy with an overnight low of 38. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 51. Today in history, in 1995, Toy Story was released. It was the first movie to have been made with completely computer-generated imagery. The quote of the day is from English writer and philosopher Aldous Huxley, who died today in 1963. He said, quote, "There is only one corner of the universe you can be certain on improving, and that's yourself." We're 2 weeks past the midterm election, but the question still remains, was democracy on the ballot? Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Thanks and hello, everyone. What a difference a day makes, as the old song goes. On election day, liberals and progressives feared the worst, a solidly MAGA takeover of the House and Senate. Consider these expectations that proved unwarranted. MAGA election deniers would get control of key election posts and the machinery in the battleground states. Voting would be marked by violence and intimidation in many places around the country. Every Republican defeat would be followed by charges of fraud, unwillingness of losing candidates to concede, and threats directed at federal attempts to intercede. Young Black and Latino voters would not come out for Democrats in high numbers. Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell would be riding high. And finally, democracy would be on the ropes, with many predictions of end times. On that last point, democracy survival, we need a qualification along with a celebration. Fact is, not a single one of the defeated far-right candidates, nor any Republican office holder, has accepted the idea that democracy, our constitutional system, was on the ballot and successfully defended. All their attention is focused on blaming others for the failure to win big time. Trump, the Republican National Committee, McCarthy, or McConnell. Even then, sentiment on Trump is equivocal, with some Republicans saying the party needs other candidates, or needs less drama, or needs to consider his good policies, besides the recent election results. But there are plenty of others who are true or pretend believers, that rock-bottom 30% of Republicans. Now that Trump is officially running, let's watch the backtracking on criticism of him, along with forgiveness of McCarthy's and McConnell's sins. McCarthy in particular will need Trump in order to keep the MAGAites in line, so expect him to remain a loyal Trump follower all the way to 2024. I thus think it is premature to say, as the Washington Post's Jennifer Rubin writes, that while threats to democracy remain, 2022 might be seen as the point at which the erosion of democratic values and critical institutions were halted. The threats are just as real today as they were on Election Day. The MAGAites are surely plotting a comeback. Trump, who cannot tolerate losing, will be rallying his troops. He's far from dead. After all, he will say he didn't lose. Losers lost because they didn't listen to him. McCarthy will be working on how to undermine Biden's agenda. The election deniers at every level of government will lick their wounds and return with a vengeance. As one writer puts it, quote, "The combination of resentment, rule-bending, and shamelessness that gave rise to Mr. Trump's presidency is still the reigning attitude of the party. Distrust of and disdain for democratic outcomes shape the party's agenda both internally and externally, unquote. DeSantis, anyone? We can't rest assured that 2 years from now, the same people who voted to save democracy, or save women's rights, or healthcare, or labor rights, or the environment, will come out again for Democrats, or in the same numbers. Nor can we assume that all those Democrats who won by thin margins will be reelected. Look again at those numbers and see how brittle these victories were, especially in Senate races. 4% and 5% wins in Pennsylvania and Arizona, a 0.8% win in Nevada, a 1% loss in Wisconsin, and a runoff in Georgia. Republicans in state legislatures they control will continue to gerrymander and employ other devices designed to thwart democratic processes, most of all the law. Moral of the story? What the far right has done before, it will do again. Finally, we can't assume that today's key political issues will be the same in 2024. The economy might take a nosedive. The U.S.-China or U.S.-Russia confrontations might be even more perilous. A crisis over immigration might be the central domestic concern. Gridlock seems very likely in Congress, and in the House particularly, Kevin McCarthy will have his hands full attending to the demands of the far-right faction. And inevitably, it seems, there's the Trump factor, which comes into play in various forms. The January 6th committee, which the House Republicans will terminate on day one of the new term, the Georgia investigation of Trump's and others' interference in the 2020 election, and Trump's removal of classified documents from the White House. Will the U.S. Department of Justice or the Fulton County District Attorney's probes lead to indictments of Trump and associates? And how will the MAGAites react if they do? We cannot exclude the possibility of electoral violence just because it didn't happen this time around. In short, Democrats should assume they'll be back in the trenches fairly soon. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
Iran announced yesterday that it has begun enriching uranium to 60% purity at its underground Fordo nuclear site. Iran has already been enriching uranium up to 60% purity elsewhere, below the approximately 90% needed to produce weapons-grade material. But that figure is well above the 20% Iran produced before an agreement with major powers to cap enrichment at just under 4%. The International Atomic Energy Agency passed a resolution last week ordering Iran to cooperate urgently with their investigation into uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The Iranian Students News Agency, one of the country's major media outlets, reported Iran had informed them of the decision to produce 60% enriched uranium at Fordo, a site buried inside a mountain. The 2015 nuclear pact between Iran and six world powers lets Iran use only fairly rudimentary centrifuges, but Tehran has subsequently installed more efficient and more advanced machines. The enrichment at Fordo was barred under the deal. U.S. officials said, "We prefer to use diplomacy to rein in Iran's nuclear program," but added all options were available to President Biden. What some feel is code for the possible military action. Talks between Iran and the United States aimed at reviving their accord have been stalled since September, both sides demanding more flexibility. Iran's crackdown on anti-government protests, plus their sale of drones to Russia, have lessened Washington's interest in reviving a nuclear deal. Iran denies selling drones to Russia for use in the Ukraine war. Mohammad Eslami, head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, said, quote, "We had said that Iran will seriously react to any resolution and political pressure. That is why Iran has started enriching uranium up to 60% purity from Monday at the Fordo site," end quote. November is National Adoption Month. Brett Pivato tells us how interest in adopting is growing in Indiana and elsewhere.
November is National Adoption Month, and survey results suggest attitudes about adoption are changing. A recent Harris poll found that the number of Americans considering adoption was 37%, which is the highest rate since the survey began in 2007. More than 1,500 children in Indiana currently are in need of an adoptive home. Michelle Savio is adoption program manager for the Indiana Department of Child Services. She says some of the myths around adoption include the idea that some children aren't adoptable or that you have to be a perfect person.
People believe that you have to have this perfect persona to be an adoptive parent. I think anybody can do it. They have a desire to parent and are willing to make a commitment. Anybody can parent, and all children are adoptable, and you don't have to be perfect to do it.
She says other myths include that you have to be married or young, or that it's expensive to adopt. Adoption is a life-altering event, and Savio says all children they work with have had some type of trauma in their lives. This often results in traumatic behaviors or challenges that make parenting more difficult. Savio says that in 2023, adoptive parents will be required to undergo annual training similar to that required of foster parents.
In the past, Indiana has not licensed adoptive families. I believe that effective in 2023, we are going to require the same ongoing training for adoptive families that we do for foster families.
She says that the agency has learned that ongoing training gives parents skills to identify trauma behaviors as they are happening and avoid perceiving them as an attack.
With adoptive families, it's really important for them to be able to recognize trauma behaviors, because what we often see is that when the children are demonstrating behaviors, parents become challenged, and when they can reframe that and recognize that it's not an attack on them as a parent, it allows them to kind of take a step back and parent the children differently.
For Indiana News Service, I'm Brett Pivoteau.
Experts offer advice on avoiding holiday scams. Eric Galatas tells us more.
As holiday shopping kicks into high gear, security experts are offering tips for avoiding efforts by scammers to separate people from their hard-earned money. Carl Murphy with the Colorado Credit Union points to one increasingly common phishing scam where fraudsters pose as a delivery representative from a trusted company via text or email to get people to hand over their credit card or other sensitive information.
They're posing as UPS and saying, if you pay this $3 charge, we'll deliver this package to you. People tend to not have an issue with paying $3. It's a very small amount, but once you provide your card information, they're now using that card information to do much larger purchases.
Murphy says it's a good idea to review credit card, banking, and other accounts at least once a month. If you notice charges that could be fraudulent, file a dispute before protections expire, generally 60 days after your statement drops. If you believe you are the victim of identity theft, visit stopfraudcolorado.gov for steps to take. It's also a good idea to file a police report to start a paper trail. To make it harder for fraudsters to crack account passwords using software that lets them zip through thousands of possible combinations, Murphy suggests making passwords longer. For example, instead of your dog's name 123, make it Spot Loves Taking Long Walks 123. Consumers tend to be more exposed during internet transactions, and Murphy says many credit cards offer settings where cards can only be used online when you decide to unlock it.
Ever since chips came out on cards, it is a little harder for fraudsters to clone your card and get away with fraud inside of stores. So instead, they are turning toward e-commerce fraud.
Many Coloradans decide to help nonprofits and charities during end-of-year fundraising appeals. Murphy says do your homework to ensure that the organization is real and actually doing the work. As a general rule, Murphy says never provide any sensitive personal information on a call that you did not initiate.
One important tip is to not answer phone calls of phone numbers that you do not recognize. If it's an important phone call, they will probably call a second time, or they will leave a voicemail, or these days they will probably text you. Scammers tend to move on.
This is Eric Galatas reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
A community food bank in the Southwest wants to help people grow more trees. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. With their low-spreading branches, mesquite trees provide cooling shade in the Southwest, and the pods they produce have long been a source of food for indigenous communities there.
The mesquite pod was a significant part of the diet for thousands and thousands of years in this region.
Victor Miguel Ceballos Lira is with the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona in Tucson. The group is leading a project to help people grow and care for velvet mesquite trees in their neighborhoods. The primary goal is to provide shade to some of the city's hottest neighborhoods.
The south part of Tucson has been historically under-resourced, and there are not a lot of tree canopies there. If you go to the northern part of Tucson and it's 87 degrees there, and then you just drive 10 miles south, it'll be 100 degrees.
Planting shade trees can help reduce this inequity. And as part of the project, local groups will also teach people how to grind mesquite pods into flour, knowledge that's been lost in many communities. so the effort aims to help Tucson adapt to climate change and bring back cultural traditions. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 22nd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Autumn. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Brett Prevetto, Eric Galatas, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. My name is Sam. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show focused on the ongoing efforts to create a new police oversight system in Portland. For the past several months, my co-host Jasmine and I have been focusing on the police accountability.